forth on the website, so I'm just going to assume that's correct.
Valentine.
Our town clerk is living in the future.
That's right.
I'm going to join her. All right. Before we begin, this is a regular business meeting, so before we begin our regularly printed agenda, we will recognize people who are here to speak on matters that are not on our printed agenda. I believe I see two people signed up to speak about flooding issues in the Plantation Acres area. Is that separate? Okay. So, Laurel Innan?
Laurel
Linan. Laurel Innan.
Laura.
Laura.
Linan.
Linan. If you would come up to the podium here and stand at that microphone and address us.
Set?
Go for it.
Well, thank you very much. I want to appreciate the opportunity to talk with you a little bit about the issue in Plantation Acres, and I'm here on behalf of many of our neighbors who are also here. We circulated an email when we've had recent flooding in our neighborhood, and as a result of that activity, we had not only immediate outpouring of response from our listserv, but we have a petition that's been signed by 42 neighbors in the community, some of which are here today and might have additional things to say. But I'd like to read that petition and then a couple of the comments from the emails, and then I should, if that's okay, go for it.
Go for it.
So our petition, which now has 42 signatures, says, "We, the undersigned, are homeowners and taxpayers seeking the Town of Carrboro's assistance in preventing further flood damage to our homes and property. We own property and pay taxes on or near the banks of Tom's Creek, which has experienced a dramatic increase in the frequency and intensity of flood events over the last 2 years. Many of us have suffered significant property damage in these events. We ask the Town of Carrboro's Department of Public Works to address the urgency of this issue by ordering a thorough reevaluation of the area's hydrology and existing infrastructure. We hope this evaluation will lead to new solutions for maintaining Tom's Creek, as well as a clear understanding of the rights and responsibilities of property protection. For example, if rain events repeatedly make the creek rise to a foot or more above the top of the drainage culverts installed beneath streets and Plantation Acres, we believe the culverts are no longer of adequate size. We seek the Town of Carrboro's assistance in maintaining the integrity of our property." So as I said, we sent this email, neighbors responded, and asked if they would sign a petition, many of whom are here today. The overwhelming response of support has included many grim tales of flooding and damage, as well as the unanimous lack of response from town officials over the last decade in some cases where people have said they've called and asked for some assistance. So I'm going to read just a couple of the quotes from the emails. Number one, "I'm happy to sign a petition. The creek down in the 200 block is also a mess. The other week, ours at 211 and our neighbor at 209 had a river through our backyards. It was not as bad as yesterday, but still the creek was rushing." A second, "I would add to the current flood concerns that the proposed development of the Lloyd property is only likely to increase current flooding issues, development not known to make things like flooding better. For example, properties adjacent to the McDougall School have all seen, so I am told, increased water control problems. Last week, my yard flooded, and the water did begin to enter the house at the front entry, though stopped just short of actually flooding the interior. I've approached two mayors, the town lawyer, and the public works in the past 15 years to no avail. So at this time, I called 911, and the fire department came out. My husband and I also documented recent flooding in our backyard where the creek flowed well over its banks. We are at 214 James Street and would be willing to sign a petition and be part of the discussion regarding Tom's Creek. I understand anything I could do personally to protect my own property from flooding would impact my neighbors, and the town would most likely prohibit me from constructing anything. That is a community problem. And finally, Tom's Creek, south of Carroll Street, belongs to 220 James Street on the corner of Carroll and James. It is backed up on the properties of 107 Melba Circle and the 200 James Street and 400 Lorraine Street properties before flowing under Lorraine Street. I am happy to sign such a petition, but think also that the owners of those properties who may not be on the mailing list should also be encouraged to sign. So there's many more examples here, and we really appreciate the opportunity to come in and share those with you. We are concerned citizens. We're taxpayers. We've seen the number of flooding and the intensity of flooding go up over time. That's been a big concern. I've been a property owner for 13 years and have witnessed this myself. I run right along, my property runs right along Tom's Creek, and it's like a raging river and has overflowed several times on my property and others. But the main thing we realized in sending this petition out is that this is not just a property owner, one or two property owners. It's really our whole neighborhood, and I think we have a shared concern. So we appreciate your ability to sort of help share in that concern and any help. We know there was a Army Corps of Engineers evaluation done. We don't know that action was taken on all of those recommendations before. We'd really like to have some consideration of another evaluation done, or at least some action taken so that we can prevent further damage in our neighborhood. So thank you very much. And I think there might be some other neighbors here to speak as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Alan Spalt. I should say former Alderman Alan
well.
Spalt.
Greetings. Good evening, all of you. I just want to add a few things to what Laura said, because I think she captured both the sort of acute problems that some are facing and the fact that it is a little water basin problem that that affects more than one person, and solving a problem for one house may not solve or even make worse others. But and our house is not threatened. We see water rise substantially. I want to give you an example of what happened the last time, though, when one of our neighbors' house was flooded. I didn't realize that at the time, but I went out and looked and took a couple of pictures, and we're between Rainbow and Carroll, and the streets with culverts under them really form dams, and the water coming to Rainbow, which is upstream, goes through a couple of 3-foot culverts, and it was going through pretty well. But when it got to Carroll Street, the next street down, and it's a short block, you're familiar with it, the same size culverts, but there's more water because there's substantially increased drainage that comes down between those two streets. We drain the whole upper part of Carroll into that. It comes in there. And those culverts at Carroll are not the same are exactly the same size as the ones at Rainbow. So there's more water, and they couldn't get through, and so it backed up. And then it goes all the way up to the level of Carroll Street, which is several feet above the top of the culverts. And that takes it into a house, threatens another house. And yet, if we just made those culverts bigger, which would solve that problem perhaps, you've already heard that there's problems in the 200 block, which is downstream from that. So it's something that requires not just me going out and measuring the size of the culverts and making a suggestion. It really requires some hydrologist who can figure out how do we go. And this is a problem that Carborough has faced over a long period of time, because ours is a neighborhood that was developed before there was substantial concern. There are lots that wouldn't be allowed today, but they are allowed, and they're legal lots, and they have houses on them. We've lived there since 1984, and one of the things I want to support about the petition is that the situation has gotten worse over time. We've had the worst flooding this year that I can remember, even including hurricanes in the past. I don't know what all the changes are. It hasn't immediately followed the sidewalk construction, which was designed to make things no worse than they were. But they are worse now. And so somewhere water is coming faster and not getting away as fast as it needs to. So basically I just want to support this issue because we're not going to stop the rains, but we need to deal with the water.
Thanks, Alan. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
All right.
Could I just ask everybody who's here from our neighborhood to raise a hand? That might help. Thanks.
Thanks, y'all. All right. I think probably what we're going to need is a report back from our town staff about what the possible solutions are or possible ways to address this issue are. I think if I might, I just want to add that I think. Well, look, the fire department's interrupting me. We reprimand them later. I think it's worth realizing that the number one source of water pollution in the entire United States is no longer factories or farms or any of the things that we traditionally kind of think of, that traditionally come to mind when we think about water pollution. Number one source of water pollution is stormwater runoff. That is to say, the stormwater, the rainwater that washes off of our streets and our rooftops and our parking lots and our driveways and so forth. And I'm not just talking about Carrboro. I'm talking about across the entire United States of America. And for many years, the town of Carrboro has been leading our state and our nation in attempting to put in place regulations which require developers of new developments to address this issue, to try and capture more of the stormwater runoff on their properties and to slow down the pace of stormwater runoff. And the reason, let me just back up and say, the reason that stormwater runoff, that rainwater falling from the sky ends up polluting our streets is not because that rainwater is polluted, but because as we drive our cars around, as we live our lives, as our cars leak transmission fluid or oil or whatever, we deposit various pollutants onto the ground in our communities. And particularly in urban areas, it's a big problem because there's a bigger concentration of cars and streets and roads and parking lots. And that water, as it runs, the stormwater as it runs off, picks up the pollutants that are deposited on your driveway, on my driveway, on our rooftops, on our streets, and washes it into the creeks and rivers. And more recently, the state of North Carolina has begun to follow our lead. Frankly, actually, they've begun to, frankly, get almost out front of where we have been working on this issue. Alan Spalt, former alderman, has been working on this issue for years and years. We have adopted, as a state, more and more stringent requirements because all of the pollution that's washing off these streets is washing down into Jordan Lake, which is an important issue not just for the fish that live in Jordan Lake or for the trees that are trying to grow in between here and Jordan Lake, but for the people who rely on Jordan Lake as a drinking water supply, City of Cary and Apex and soon Durham and many other communities further downstream on the Cape Fear River. My point is that while it is tempting to say, well, we just need bigger and bigger culverts to move that water faster and faster out of our community and down to Jordan Lake and let Jordan Lake deal with it. The problem with that type of solution is that it means transporting more pollutants faster into Jordan Lake and polluting Jordan Lake still further. On the other hand, obviously, it's not really an acceptable solution to say, well, we'll just let it flood people's houses. We'll just let it flood people's yards. So I'm just trying to make the point that this issue is complex in that it's, number one, it's not as simple as simply increasing the size of culverts and increasing the capacity of Tom's Creek to the bed of Tom's Creek to drain this water away faster and faster, because that means If that's all you're doing, that means that what you're doing is transporting the various pollutants that we're all, through our cars and other means, depositing on our in our community. All of which is to say, number one, that it's a complex issue, and the other point I want to make is that while it sort of may not sound like that big of a deal to replace a culvert underneath a street, underneath Carroll Street or underneath Rainbow or some of these other streets, the fact is that the replacement of existing culverts is a very expensive proposition, and that each culvert that might need to be replaced or altered can run into, you know, $100,000 or even hundreds of thousands of dollars, because the cost of construction of new culverts is extremely high. So I don't mean to go on and on, but if there is a motion from the board, I think what we would probably do tonight is to refer this question to our town staff and ask them to bring back some feedback to us about what kinds of solutions might be possible, bearing in mind our desire to, on the one hand, prevent flooding of existing homes in our community, but also, on the other hand, bearing in mind that sloughing this problem off onto other people further downstream is not necessarily a great solution.
So moved.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, that passes unanimously.
Thanks, Mark.
So what will happen now is that our town staff has been sort of formally assigned a piece of homework here to look at the situation and come back to us sometime later this fall. Hopefully we have some email contact information for the homeowners in your neighborhood, and we will attempt to make sure that we let y'all know when this matter is going to come back before the board. They'll bring their homework back and report back to us, and we'll have some future meeting either later this fall or perhaps early next year, when we will hear back from the town staff about this, and we'll take up the discussion from there. Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for coming out.
Yeah, it's terrible. Appreciate it.
And just so y'all know, this is a typical process that happens when folks bring issues. It's staff that puts it in a lot of the work and then comes back to us for later. So don't feel like we're blowing you off or anything.
That's sort of part of my point. Is this is our regular process? Is when we hear a petition like this, that we would ask for our staff to give us their professional opinion, and then we'll. After we've heard that professional opinion, then we'll decide on what kind of course of action we can take to try and address the issue. All right. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you. Mark, can I just ask you, the thing that I'm wondering about is the study that had already been done, we've never seen the results of that, and if we start from scratch, that may be a place to start with some information. I don't know how long ago that was. Sounds like quite a while ago.
There was apparently some kind of Army Corps of Engineers study. Okay, so that'll be.
They made recommendations, and we don't have any reason to think that those things have been implemented.
Okay.
But it might be worthy of consideration at this present time as well.
Okay, so we'll make a point of having the staff use the whatever research the Army Corps of Engineers has done in the past on this issue as a launching off point for their analysis.
And was that on Plantation Acres or Tom's Creek or both?
I don't know exactly.
Okay. All right, we'll see what's there.
Jackie.
As I recall, there were issues surrounding runoff back when the post office was built and was in planning, because that was probably one of the first things to have a big impact on your water there was when that was covered over and paved over, and and all of that. So we may, in order to find those documents, look back at when the post office was built, which was, in my best estimate, some years ago. And that would probably 91 to 93.
Somewhere in that time frame.
Yeah.
All right.
Can I make a point? You know, in as much as Lloyd Property is being looked at as potential development, there's a question here on whether, for a single property, given the history and what's going on with this neighborhood, whether there's higher standards that would be applied, and so that's a question for Mike, and I'd be interested in seeing about that, because we don't want to exacerbate something that's already really bad.
Development of the Lloyd property, how that, the impact that that might have on.
Well, if they, like, include it in part of our understanding of what kind of mitigation options we have.
Okay.
Thanks.
It probably would be helpful to have, among other things, when that comes back to us, kind of a map that shows us the entire Toms Creek watershed, so we can understand where the various developments are in, that have happened in recent years with respect to the entire watershed. I can think of, since that 1993 time period, I can think of two significant real estate development. I think the elementary and middle school mm-hmm. is in the
right.
top end of
Huge.
The watershed, mm-hmm. and then there was also that development what is that thing called? Anyway, at just north of Rainbow, a little bit up there, they built a bunch of new houses, or they're building
Lloyd
a bunch
Square.
Of
Lloyd
Square.
Square.
Yeah. Anyway, is the other one that comes to mind. Anyway, we need to look at mm-hmm. the entire watershed to understand it. Alan?
If I could, I suggest that the staff, might be helpful to the staff to meet at some point with some or all the neighbors, because I think that there's a lot of practical experiences exactly what specific problems there are that Corps of Engineers may have identified or may not have, rather than just, this is not a theoretical problem, and so a community meeting with staff might be a useful thing, and I'm sure mm-hmm. people will be willing to cooperate.
Mr. Manager. Well,
somebody give me a call, and we'll get it going, get it set up, and find out who we need to be in touch with. So we've talked to a lot of you before.
Someone asked about emails. We have a listserv, so we can.
We'll be glad to do that.
If you could make sure to be in touch with Catherine Wilson, our town clerk here, to make sure that she has the contact information for that email listserv, so we can let y'all know about that meeting or about any meetings that are happening in connection with the subject, that would be helpful.
I was also just going to raise the point that was made about letting folks who are in Melba Court and some of the other folks, you know, and if you folks would make sure to get in touch with them, because the east side of James is way down slope. Mark is absolutely right about the watershed of Tom's Creek, but there's all the topography is such that it just slopes right off from on the east side of James. So that would be great if you could get in touch with
them. I've walked Melba and all those streets for two nights now, and I haven't found anyone home yet, but I'm trying.
Okay.
Postcards.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right. Changing gears for a moment, or at least I'm assuming changing gears for a moment, I have James Wilson signed up to speak regarding the Collins Crossing Apartments, formerly known as Abbey Court, formerly known as, I forget, Old Well. Collins Crossing. Yes. Or perhaps entirely to be confused with Collins Crossing, but anyway. Mr. Wilson.
Hello, everyone. My name is James Wilson. I live at Abbey Court Apartments on Jones Ferry Road. Abbey Court stands perhaps along with a couple of the surrounding complexes near the intersection of Jones Ferry and 54 as the last place in Carborough for low-income people to live. Many of you may know that Abbey Court was recently bought and renamed Collins Crossing. When we first came to live here, we paid $520 a month in rent. Our lease was just now temporarily renewed for 6 months, and the rent raised to $560. That's not a huge increase, for some of the residents, but it's not for others. For example, some of my neighbors were recently forced to abandon their pet Labrador because they can no longer afford to feed him, both him and their six children, on less than $20,000 a year. But that's by no means the end of the issue. If you go on Collins Crossing website, you can see something of a transparent marketing push toward more affluent folks, like some college students. Like, four plans at the complex are called things like the Ram and the Tar Heel and the UNC. Aside from how any two-bedroom apartment could remotely find a Ram, this stinks of unabashed gentrification to me. Empty apartments are being renovated and rented out at $720 a month. That's a 140% hike. No one who currently lives in Collins Crossing could begin to afford that amount. I'm aware that the Board of Aldermen is unable to do a considerable amount about these things. I'm not asking for that, but I'm asking you to consider my thoughts and consider what Carver would do without what little diversity it has left. And I am asking you to put what support and weight you can behind any effort to preserve Carver's socioeconomic diversity. Thank you.
Thank you. Obviously it's a tough situation. We have in North Carolina, there's actually a provision in our state constitution which says that the government is not allowed to regulate rents in any way. So, like, for example, in New York or California, they have rent control, that kind of thing. That type of thing is prohibited altogether in North Carolina. So it's as you said, Mr. Wilson, there's in terms of our legal authority, there's not that much we can do. But I think that there might be some things that we can do at a more kind of unofficial level to attempt to talk to the owners of Collins Crossing. It's actually a condominium, so there's one company that owns most of Collins Crossing, but by no means all of it. And I would be glad if, as I would assume, it's the Board of Aldermen's pleasure to attempt to meet with the management company in charge of Collins Crossing to discuss this issue. I know there have been in the 10 years that I've been, or 9 years that I've been mayor/member of this board, that there have been a number of times when people have attempted to when basically previous owners of Collins Crossing or Abbey Court have come to us and asked about rezoning the property, redeveloping it, tearing down the apartments that are there, building commercial developments instead of apartments and this type of thing. And up to now, the Board of Aldermen has unanimously been opposed to hearing about that because of what an important housing resource, even as kind of dubious in some ways as it sometimes is, what an important housing resource it is. So I know this board is concerned about this issue. I don't know if any of y'all have any other thoughts to share right now. Yes, ma'am.
Mark, I want to say that when Abbey Court was in the process of being sold, I thought that you had already initiated some conversations. So, you know, it would seem that, you know, if you followed that up with further conversation, if we needed to draft a letter of support for, you know, from the board, I think that would be appropriate because the groundwork's already been laid. So, I'd like to make that motion.
All right.
What's the motion?
From Mark to me, with the folks.
Did we have
the management.
Sort of a board?
I second that you are do what you're already going to do anyway.
Well, I think the notion was that there would be a sort of letter from the Board of Aldermen,
in addition
sort
to
of
that,
supporting the point of view that I'm going to try to advocate with the management company. I mean, obviously, well, I believe that the company that has purchased most of Abbey Court is some kind of real estate investment trust, like or REIT, in other words, a kind of it was basically Wall Street that bought it. Mm-hmm. And so we can all imagine from there kind of what the motivations are and what the interests of the current owners are. And, you know, I know it may seem like I'm a miracle worker, but actually, no, I'm kidding. I mean, in reality, there's probably only so much we can do, but I think, you know, perhaps there's the opportunity to try to talk to this company to emphasize that the points that Mr. Wilson just made. All right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in – oh, did somebody in the audience have a question? Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can I ask you, because I think what you're saying is so important, I really want you to come up to the microphone. Give me a look like she's maybe a little bit more shy than to usually do that. But listen, I think what you're saying is very important, and I want to have it on the record, and I want people at home to be able to hear some of our local media is not able to be here and are listening over the internet or through cable TV. So,
good afternoon, everyone. My name is Juanita Creekmore. I've lived in Abbey Court for over 4 years. I've seen people come in and come and go with it. And at one time, I was living in a two-bedroom apartment, and I had to do most of the sealing of holes, pest control, the cleaning and everything myself, even though they want their money on time. So now I have upgraded to a three-bedroom apartment, and I pay $825 a month, which they're stating that the rent will go up to at least $1,000. And I said to them, if you're going to do that, I need to have stainless steel stove, you know, washer and dryer, you know, a better bathroom and no animals running around consistently. Because at this time, when you go in the kitchen, you better have a flash water, basically. And the outside is like a recycling area where we live because you have multiple trucks there that has all kinds of metal, TVs, things there consistently. So when you look into these other issues, is it possible that you can look into the living standards and the environmental atmosphere around us also? You're welcome.
Thank you.
It was two years ago.
Thank you, Ms. Creekmore. I think two years ago, when we were in the midst of kind of a dispute with the former owner and management company at Abbey Court, there were a number of minimum housing code complaints that the town received from residents at Abbey Court, and we did a series of inspections on, I want to say it was about somewhere between 5 and 7 different units that from which we received complaints, and we found a bunch of housing code violations, and for sure every single unit from which we received a complaint. For each one, there were numerous violations of the minimum housing code that were identified. We have the power to have more of those minimum housing code inspections carried out by the town. It's normally our practice in the inspections department at the town to only do housing code violation inspections when we have received a complaint. By receiving a complaint, I just mean that we got a phone call or that we got an email
or
something.
Or somebody coming to a board meeting.
So I will point out that anybody who lives at Abbey Court or indeed anybody who lives in the town of Carrboro in any rented property has a right to contact our inspections department or any of our town departments, and we'll refer you to we'll get you in touch with the inspections department to request that type of inspection. And our past experience with this, again, 2 years ago or whenever it was that we did a series of these, was that there were a variety of problems. Probably, frankly, the most notable was that expired fire extinguisher certifications, dead batteries in smoke detectors,
stairwells,
dilapidated stairwells, and as you alluded to, insects and other pests in the apartments. So that is a possibility. In principle, North Carolina state law says that your landlord is not allowed to sort of retaliate against you for filing that type of complaint. Of course, the reality versus what the law says is, you know, it's not always 100% consistent. So it's important, I think, to bear in mind that while we are, as a town government, we're in a great position to follow up on complaints like that. It really ends up being for the courts of the state of North Carolina to look after your interests or any tenant's interests as far as making sure that the landlord does not attempt to kind of retaliate against you for making a complaint like that. I don't say that to try and scare you. I just say that to say I wish that we had the authority to protect you from or anyone at Abbey Court or anyone who rents in the town of Carrboro from retaliation. But it's simply not something that's put in our hands by state law.
Mark, is the pest issue and possibly related sanitation issues of interest to the county health department?
It could be potentially, and so, you know, I'm not trying to be too wishy-washy about this, but I'm trying to say that when we receive a complaint, and all that we need for a complaint is a phone call probably tomorrow morning to our inspections department, you can count on us to respond quickly and to attempt to determine as best as we can whether there is any minimum housing code violation going on at any particular apartment. I'll also make sure that point is very clear to the management company when I have the conversation that Mr. Wilson's comments kind of inspired earlier tonight. All right?
So we need to vote.
Okay. All those in favor, I thought we voted, but all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right. Thank you, Mr. Wilson and Ms. Creekmore, for bringing the situation. It was already at our attention, but even more to our attention. I believe that brings us to we have a proclamation that I would like to read. This is a proclamation concerning National Community Planning Month, and before I read it, I'll just point out that the last two items that we just heard about could not put more of an exclamation point behind the point of this proclamation. Whereas change is constant and affects all cities, towns, suburbs, counties, boroughs, townships, rural areas, and other places, and whereas community planning and plans can help manage this change in a way that provides better choices for how people work and live, and community planning provides an opportunity for all residents to be meaningfully involved in making choices that determine the future of their community. And whereas the full benefits of planning require public officials and citizens who understand, support, and demand excellence in planning and plan implementation. And whereas the month of October is designated as National Community Planning Month throughout the United States and its territories. And whereas the American Planning Association and its professional institute and the American Institute of Certified Planners endorse the National Community Planning Month as an opportunity to highlight the contributions, sound planning, and plan implementation that make for the quality of our settlements and environments. And whereas the Town of Carrboro Planning Department has planned a series of three affordable housing dialogue sessions in October to recognize National Community Planning Month. And whereas the celebration of National Community Planning Month gives us the opportunity to publicly recognize the participation and dedication of the town's planning board and planning staff, other advisory boards, and citizen planners who have contributed their time and expertise to the improvement of the town of Carrboro. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Mark Chilton, Mayor of the Town of Carrboro, North Carolina, do hereby proclaim the month of October 2012 as National Community Planning Month in the Town of Carrboro in conjunction with the celebration of National Community Planning Month. This is the second day of October 2012, and I would like to ask Damon Siles from our planning board to come join me at the podium. Do you want to stand there? Well, I'm going to sign this proclamation right before your eyes, Damon, and give you a copy of this and invite you to say a few words.
He really did sign it. I just want to briefly acknowledge that several members of the planning board have been working extra hours, including some members that are here tonight. And as a result of their hard work, actually, the reason this applies to the comments in the previous item is that the three sessions that the mayor mentioned are going to be on affordable housing in Carrboro. And because of the planning board's work, we've gotten some participation commitments from affordable housing advocates and experts at the North Carolina Housing Coalition, UNC Center for Community Capital, the Department of City and Regional Planning, and the Orange County Partnership to End Homelessness. Representatives from these groups are going to be helping us not only facilitate the sessions that we hold this month, but they're also doing some background research that's it's going to be new information, I think, for a lot of us on Carrboro's specific experience with housing diversity and access. Our hope is that, as you know, some of you are working on reviewing the town's affordable housing strategy now. Our hope is that this effort will complement that and provide you with some important new information. Our first session will take place here in this room on Monday, October 15th at 7 o'clock in the evening. Free and open to the public, and I'm told there will be snacks. So please come out. We do want lots of participation from the community. It's important to hear from people who are experiencing problems with affordable housing and access to affordable housing. And that's what these sessions are meant to promote, is discussion on those issues.
Right. What will the snacks be?
Tell me what you want.
I can't promise anything.
Okay, so that meeting then is the first of those meetings.
The first of the meetings will be here Monday the 15th.
2 weeks from last night.
That's right, at 7 p.m. And then there's a second session.
The 24th.
That's right, on the 24th, the same time at the at Owassa. And then the third session is on the 30th, which is a Tuesday. But there's not an alderman meeting that night. And that one will be at the Century Center, again at the same time and with probably different snacks.
Mark, I just want to make
a comment.
I want to thank the planning board and the subcommittee of the planning board. They've been working on this since last spring, and they've just done a wonderful job. And it's a great way of bringing community and planning together. So thank you, subcommittee, and thank you, planning board.
And if I might, I just want to say, you know, I think a lot of times folks who come to these meetings or who interact with our town government may not realize this, but the people who work in our planning department for the town of Carrboro, they work on salary. They're not They're not on a they're not on an hourly clock. They're not on a commission. And I can say for sure from my own observation that most of them work at least 50 hours a week, and sometimes when the situation calls for it, 60 hours a week and more. And so I just want to appreciate everybody who is in our planning department for all of the hard work that they do for our community in reviewing developments and planning for the future of our community. They're here late at night. They're here. I see at least three of them here. At least three of them here tonight at this very moment. Four. When we have community meetings on Saturdays, on Sundays, late at night, early in the morning, that they are there to help make our town a better place. And we really appreciate all that all of you do for our community. Thank you. All right. I believe that brings us to our consent agenda. One of the items, before we even begin our consent agenda, though, let me just say, one of the items I know on the consent agenda is the Hillsborough Road and James Street intersection improvements or safety improvements. I see there are a number of people in the audience who have a special interest in that topic. So I don't know whether y'all were hoping to speak on that item. I don't have anybody signed up right now, but
we don't have any decision before us tonight on that. It's just an update.
I'd like to just pull the item and briefly speak to the memo we got tonight.
Okay, so let's consider the agenda item. The consent agenda without that item, so that we can have just a brief discussion after the consent agenda about the Hillsborough and James Street intersection. Mr. Manager.
Okay, thank you, Mayor and members of the board. You do have three other items on your consent agenda: the minutes from September 18th and September the 25th, also a report for the Jordan Lake Stormwater Rules, the Nutrient Offset Program, and finally a resolution approving the records retention and disposition schedule per the state of North Carolina. Mr. Mayor.
Move items 1, 3, and 4.
Second.
All right. Items 1, 3, and 4 have been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Lydia, did you have a specific question you wanted to ask about item C2?
I just want to say item C2, which was an update on safety improvements at the intersection of Hillsborough Road and James Street. I know that members of the community have contacted us by emails asking questions about how, if it's possible, sooner than later, we can get some kind of traffic calming measures put in place. And I don't know if – I know, Trish, you provided us with a – Trish and I guess and Christina provided us with a memo answering some of those questions. I don't know if one of you would maybe just briefly summarize some of the questions about specifically traffic calming and how – if that can happen sooner than later. Okay, or Jeff, fine. Yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I see. CC from Jeff, yes.
Thank you. That's what I was going to ask. Thank you.
Thanks. Since August of 2011, when this first issue was first brought to the attention of the board and staff by a member of the neighborhood, staff have been communicating with neighbors regarding their concerns with pedestrian safety at the crosswalk. And since then, a number of different actions have taken place. Of course, there have been two temporary traffic calming measures that reflect the recommendation in the now approved Safe Routes to School Action Plan for improving safety at the intersection. And there's been further communication as we are still underway with our second trial traffic calming measure about further measures that can be taken. NCDOT in August of this past August updated the crosswalk markings to be high visibility. That was a town staff request. And town staff have also requested that NCDOT install new signage, which is this sign right here. You see it at most crosswalks at the intersection. I'll get to that a little bit later. I'm going to go quickly through this, though. Subsequently, there was a question as to whether signage or traffic calming within Hillsborough Road, as Lydia pointed out, could be pursued. And, of course, since it's a state-maintained road, any measure would need NCDOT approval. NCDOT, from my past experience, is unlikely to approve of some types of traffic calming measures on arterial roadways. There is a general statute that now allows them to install traffic calming measures on subdivision roads, which are generally in rural areas that the state still maintains. There may be other traffic calming measures that would be more viable to be approved. Any traffic calming measure might affect the lane configuration. For instance, if you were to put a pedestrian refuge island at the crosswalk, that might kind of split the lanes out a little bit more, and then you have to kind of think about what the impact would be on the bike lanes that exist. There's also been communication from neighbors about potentially installing a in-street yield to pedestrian sign, which is present at crosswalks in the downtown area, Weaver, Greensboro, Main Streets. And town staff have considered that. It's a little bit different environment out there. The 85th percentile speeds in the downtown area are more like 20 to 30 miles an hour, and out here they are 40 to 45. So we want to make sure that you don't install something that then gets ignored by motorists, at the same time, I think that there's a potential for a trial run with one of these signs, subject to, you know, Public Works' opinion as well, to test how well they work, how well they increase compliance, yielding compliance at the crosswalk, and to make sure they don't get knocked down all the time.
Jeff, before you leave that slide, on our memo, it doesn't indicate that necessarily needs DOT approval, but up there you say that it needs DOT approval?
It would need DOT approval. We've been successful in getting NCDOT approval for such a sign at the Shelton and Greensboro crosswalk.
If the board wanted you to pursue that, in your experience, how quickly do they give approval?
That's hard to say.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's a diplomatic answer.
Okay. All right.
let's see. I already talked about this crosswalk sign a little bit. Typically, it's combined with the arrow plaque pointing down at the crosswalk, and sometimes, oftentimes, it is, instead of yellow, it's a fluorescent green color. And we think this would be a priority, and we've asked... just today, I emailed NCDOT for an update on whether they plan to install these signs. In terms of advance warning signs, there already is an advance warning sign and beacon north of Parkview Avenue for southbound motorists. And that's the downhill section, so that's the section where cars are going a little bit faster than the northbound section. There's also less visibility, less sight distance in the southbound direction. And another option that has been used recently in Chapel Hill that increases the visibility even more of the crosswalk is this edge-lit W112 or edge-lit crosswalk sign that has LED lights literally on the border. And it's controlled by – it's solar-powered, so there's no need to trench the roadway to connect to a power source. And I believe it has some type of timing mechanism so that the lights might not be on 24/7, but I have to check that to make sure. Town of Chapel Hill staff said that the cost for each sign was $2,300.
Jeff, with regard to those signs, is that a DOT determination of whether, like, if there's already a sign there, and if we say we want to pay for it to be lit, or I don't know if they pay for it to be lit, or if we do, is it pro forma that those signs could be replaced, or do you know?
I don't know. Since this is such a new technology, mm-hmm. I think that might be a case-by-case basis. If you recall, we've tried in the past to get approval for two rectangular rapid flashing beacons. I think there's an image of that in the mm-hmm. abstract, which are just the flashing lights underneath the crosswalk, and that has not been approved. So I think in this case, too, I couldn't tell for sure whether they would approve it.
Right. I mean, anecdotally, just to the board, I'm not saying this for Hillsborough, but I know along Greensboro, I think a couple of those crosswalks that are in the bend right before you get to Harris Teeter, when you're making the bend, that might be something worth pursuing. Go ahead.
Another few notes. We have tentatively, we have received news that tentatively NCDOT has been able to find funding for the permanent installation of the curb extension and traffic calming measure that we've requested. I want to stress that it's tentative and it will be reviewed by the Board of Transportation, the statewide Board of Transportation, in November. So working with Mike Mills, the division engineer, and Don McPherson, the division traffic engineer, and others, I wanted to note that they have looked into this funding request and they have tentatively stated that they have found funding for it. So we'll be able to follow up with them and present more information to the board as needed on that. The conceptual sketch of the traffic calming does include a small rain garden that would be installed adjacent to the curb extension and provide stormwater management. And we don't know yet if that would be included in the funding request, but Randy Dodd and I have been communicating with the NC State Extension staff members who have been working with Randy on some of the stormwater management and water quality projects that the planning department has ongoing, and they have stated that a rain garden would be feasible. It would be a location for a small rain garden, so we wanted to put that out there and say that may be able to be included in the project, but we're not certain.
All right. Thanks, John.
Folks, would you be interested in entertaining a motion to ask staff to investigate an in-street yield sign of NCDOT?
Yes, with the edge lit solar.
I'm speaking right now just specifically to an in-street yield sign in the middle of the street. Asking them to investigate and see if NCDOT will approve that, and then that way, then it could. And actually. Then we would, I guess, as it says here in the memo, study the effects on how that works, I guess, before something more permanent.
I'll second that.
All right.
Let's go ahead and vote. There's a couple other possibilities, but let's go ahead and vote on just that.
Okay.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Randy, did you want to?
Yeah, I'm very interested in the possibility of the solar edge lit. Especially in that spot, because I think that.
I'll second that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I guess I just have one question or thought, which is oftentimes it's important to early on in our relationship with the Department of Transportation to establish a kind of precedent about the question of the costs of various things. So I feel like protecting pedestrians who are trying to cross our state highways is not merely the responsibility of local governments, but is really the responsibility, ultimately, of our state government. And so I would like to just throw into that mix that I believe our town staff ought to aggressively pursue the notion that the state ought to pay, you know, I forget, when we do various highway improvements, I think we pay a certain small percentage and they pay 80-90%. But, you know, from my perspective, this ought to fall into that category too, where some local match might be a reasonable proposal, but that the great majority of the funding really ought to come from the state.
I think that was implicit in both motions.
Okay. All right, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, matter passed unanimously. All right. I think that concludes that item.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
That brings us.
Yeah,
don't go anywhere, Jeff. That brings us to item D1, the 2040 Metropolitan Transportation Plan Alternative Analysis. I apologize to everyone. I have to step out of this meeting for just a moment. I will be back very soon, but in the meantime, I'm going to hand over the gavel to our Mayor Pro Tempore. And I'll join you in a minute.
Thank you. This is really a follow-up presentation. The board heard the bulk of the presentation earlier this month, and mainly it's to note to the board that the TAB provided some additional comments on the 2040 Metropolitan Transportation Plan developed by the MPO the alternatives analysis that is ongoing right now. The previous motion that the board made requested that the MPO include greenhouse gas emissions metrics in their research and also requested that the MPO communicate with local jurisdictions on their current greenhouse gas emissions goals. So that has been adopted by the board and forwarded to the MPO for their consideration. The TAB had a number of additional comments from their September 20th meeting. I want to stress that these reflect draft minutes, so they haven't been approved by the TAB, but these are the comments. This is a summary of the comments that they provided. They had concerns about the way that the regional travel demand model functions and concerns about greenhouse gas emissions similar to the board. They felt that the model doesn't take into account a range or take into account uncertainty, they were concerned that none of the alternatives presented, if you recall this from the earlier meeting, they were concerned that the alternatives presented did not significantly reduce the number of vehicle miles traveled estimated by the model, and if you recall, the alternatives were combinations of land use scenarios and transportation networks being highway intensive, transit intensive, and then a kind of a mixture scenario called the moderate scenario. The TEB also expressed concern that there's no comprehensive local or regional transit plan in place, and that would help determine ridership before these major investments are made. And the TAB would also like to see express transit from all major modes to the airport. So those are the comments that the TAB made. This is the next steps are for the MPO. Of course, Lydia's chair and Mark also sits on the committee to consider releasing the preferred alternative for public comment at the Wednesday, October 10th meeting. So this is really a placeholder agenda item for the board to make any additional comments on the 2040 Metropolitan Transportation Plan to the MPO or ask any more questions or receive any more information.
Jeff, would these comments be timely in terms of being available to the MPO? on the 10th at their meeting, do you think, that it would get, we get it to them, their staff, and they'd get it into the materials?
I think so. I think that the MPO, even if they get some comments after, you know, the time they release the agenda, they can provide additional comments at the meeting, during the presentation of the meeting.
Questions, comments?
I had a question about, in the last meeting, I know Sammy brought this up. He knows much more about greenhouse gases than I do. But you asked if, I think you raised the issue, and then is there a model that does measure the greenhouse gas emissions, and they're just not using that model, or what?
Yeah,
can we be more specific about a comment that we'd like to make about that? Is if there's a model, can we recommend that model to them?
There is, and while I'm not an expert on the model itself, long story short, one of the steps in this process is after the MPO adopts the Metropolitan Transportation Plan, an air quality conformity analysis needs to be done. And basically what this document does is ensure that the transportation plan does not cause motor vehicle emissions to rise above certain levels. Mm-hmm. And these emissions are include basically regulated emissions that are regulated by the EPA. That doesn't include greenhouse gas emissions, but includes other emissions like volatile organic compounds and so forth. That air quality conformity document is usually completed by Triangle J Council of Governments. And in order to model emissions, they use a software developed primarily by the EPA called Mobile 6. And Mobile 6 is primarily tailored to modeling these regulated emissions by the EPA. There is a new model called MOVES, and I know the MPO has at least discussed moving from Mobile 6 to MOVES. They're both acronyms. The difference between the two, and again, I'm definitely not an expert on this topic, so I'm speaking very generally. The difference between the two is that MOVES actually has a pretty good modeling capability for greenhouse gas emissions. Mobile 6 doesn't, has a very basic one. So MOVES is the model to use if you want to evaluate greenhouse gas emissions. And I'm almost positive that the MPO is not using it this time around, but I know they have looked into it. I'm just not sure of what their current status is as to how soon they would switch to this emissions model.
We did make a recommendation previously in regard to the measuring greenhouse gas.
Yes.
I mean, could we be more specific, though, if we want them to use this because we know this measure? We just said we wanted them to measure the greenhouse gas emissions, and it sounds like they have information and awareness of this other model that will actually do it. Can we be specific in our comments about suggesting that they use that model?
We can. If we know that's the best model.
How do we know? Yeah.
I mean, I'm certainly not in a position to
I'm
say
not either.
The
I'm
best
just,
model
it sounds like it measures what we want it to measure, and the current one doesn't, except the things that the EPA measures.
Yeah, and I wish I could be more confident in knowing exactly where the MPO stood on consideration of this new model, but again, I'm speaking in general terms.
Okay.
We could just ask Lydia to take that point
to
you know,
them,
with her to
out.
The meeting.
Okay.
Can you represent us on that point?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
We will.
Randy?
The six comments from TAB, I just want to know if you know, in our Attachment A resolution, if we should be undergirding those six comments and recommending them. I thought they were very thoughtful. I'm really glad that TAB did the work. But I didn't know if that's something we needed to add to Attachment A, and I wanted to raise that question.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thought I had about that, Randy, is, I mean, the MPO often gets recommendations from, for example, the Durham Open Space and Planning you know, commission or Durham Open Space Trails Commission or the Durham Planning Board. I think, Jeff, am I wrong? Because the public comment period is for anyone. It seems like we also could simply forward on the comments from our TAB straight to the MPO in the absence of completely agreeing with every single one of them. So.
Jackie and myself.
I'm perfectly happy to pass them on as the comments of our TAB, but not as the comments, as you said, of our board. I mean, some of these are significant policy ideas that haven't been thoroughly vetted, either with this board or with the citizens in large. Some of them have to do with big changes or handing over changes in zoning regulations and development. And I think that's just not something that we want to sign off on like that because the TAB thinks it's a good idea. It may very well be a good idea, but that's – and I also don't know if I believe that the MPO is the place that should be making the town's zoning decisions. That's getting to kind of a – I'm not sure that I want to hand that over to other entities. So I'm fine with this being passed along, with it being very clear that these are suggestions from our Transportation Advisory Board, but not that this is an agreed-upon policy statement from the Board of Aldermen. Those are two very different things.
Yeah, I actually would not be comfortable passing it on because I don't think we can pass it on without there being the implication that it to some extent represents us. So I would vote against a motion to do that. I have actually four of their points that I either don't understand or don't necessarily agree with. I mean, I don't know what the best way to proceed on this. We could just take them one by one and see what we want to include or if someone wants
that
to make
them. That would be
them.
Like a 2-hour conversation.
It would.
Probably.
It's a long time. Or we could just, you know, ask, what's the time frame on this if we wanted TAB to provide more detail on these points? Is there time later on to, or is MBR going to be wrapping it up?
There are actually some that I don't care what the details are. I'm not going to support them.
Right. So we shouldn't pass them on, is what I'm saying.
I'm the liaison. I could very quickly explain
yeah, would
not
you?
That many. The second one is the one that we talked about last week, the greenhouse gas emissions. The first one is basically there is concern by the Transportation Advisory Board that this model, because it doesn't reflect current zoning and the potential to change zoning to affect transportation, it portrays a vision of the future that we just have to be cognizant of not being set in stone. We do have the power to change that. That was our main concern. It wasn't so much that the MPO should set our zoning policies. More about us being aware that this is a model based on certain assumptions, and one of those assumptions is that land use policy will remain the way it is.
But you got to be careful what you wish for and how you word it. And that's anyway.
Right. And so, and then related to that is also regional parking pricing strategies. And the Transportation Advisory Board was speaking to UNC, for example, and how they've been able to achieve a lot of changes to the way that parking happens on campus. You know, the concern that none of these alternatives significantly change the number of miles traveled.
You skipped over the third one, which is one that I don't understand at all.
Oh, this one is related to the point of they don't give a range of estimate of what the uncertainty is with their projections, so it gives a sense of this is pretty, it's very deterministic. Like, the model is very precise about what the future would look like. And doesn't give the degree of error that may be involved. So that was a concern. And then the second to last one's pretty straightforward, that there's no local comprehensive regional transit plan. And then the last one's very self-explanatory.
So for myself, of those, the one I would add to the motion is the fourth one. And I think that's something that's pretty clear, that's been a guiding point in our own policy, seeking to reduce vehicle miles traveled.
Well, I think some of the alternatives do reduce the number of vehicle miles significantly.
Okay. Well, I'm not remembering from when we looked at it, so if that's right.
Yeah, I think so, because one was transit heavy, one was road heavy. Am I right,
Jeff? Right, but you look at the figures.
I mean, I don't want to go into any details about it. I don't want to drag it on, but...
Here is the differences. And you can see there is the alternatives are on the x-axis, and the number of vehicle miles traveled are on the y-axis. This is total VMT per capita per day. And the moderate and transit-friendly transportation networks have a lower VMT per capita than the another transit-friendly alternative, but then also...
Or then the base year, I mean.
Yeah.
Or then 2010, mm-hmm. I mean. Mm-hmm. Although it's a pretty modest decrease from the 2010 level.
Mm-hmm.
And did TAB see this chart in their deliberations?
Yeah, they did see the general numbers here, yes.
the range there is not so big. I understand, mm-hmm. Multiply that times as many people as there are, but with changes to the land use patterns, you could probably achieve more. And that's the problem with this model, is that it takes into assumption land use patterns being set.
I see. Right.
And it doesn't inspire us to change the way that we affect land use policy. It's not so much speaking about how the NPO would impose land policy on us, but rather the opportunity for being used as a tool for us to reimagine.
Right. See, that's what I was thinking.
I
agree with and appreciate the quest and the goals. I'm not sure that this is the right medium for those.
Well,
it's less about the medium. It's more about a tool to understand how to implement the zoning.
No, because you're passing it on to the MPO. And that then it becomes the medium, and I don't think that that's, in my view, the appropriate medium for Cargrove zoning and development decisions.
Mm-hmm. I think.
Can I just add 1 point to that? I would totally agree with that if we had available to us the tool, and maybe we could make that available at a staff level, but I think there is an opportunity to, I don't know how costly it is, if that were available to our planning staff to really be able to think through and play with that tool to envision and inform the way that we do zoning. And so in that sense, I think it would be valuable because, and if we don't have that tool, then there's an opportunity to think of how would we be able to have a conversation with the MPO so that we could be more informing of each other.
And that goes to the bullet that's immediately before about having a comprehensive local and regional transit plan.
Mm-hmm.
On that chart that you're showing there, total vehicle miles traveled per capita, daily miles, so you have the sort of base year 2010 listed, and then you have those various figures that are shown there. This plan is supposed to go through 2040, so 28 years from now. When it says, for example, on the highway oriented option 33, what's the assumption about 33 when? 28 years from now?
Yes, in the year 2040.
Mm. Okay. So, I feel like appreciate the comments that our advisory board made, but it seems to me, it's hard to believe that 28 years from now that anybody will be able to afford to travel 33 miles per day that the average person be able to afford to even do that. And that, you know, one of the things that really ought to be taken into consideration in this plan is the rapid way in which the cost of fuel for driving these vehicles has gone up over the last 10 years or even less than the last 10 years. It seems to me that under any of the, I mean, if I had to make a guess, I would say all these figures are going to be lower than what's being estimated here, simply because the cost of transportation is going to continue to outpace the rate at which the amount that all of us are being paid for the work we do is going up, and so which to me implies that we ought to be pursuing those models which involve public transportation and various alternatives to single passenger automobiles. I don't think any of these comments really get directly to that point.
Well, let me just point out that the TAB's comment on the third one, the uncertainty and estimate range, this one doesn't allow for that consideration.
That's the kind of uncertainty they're talking about.
Right. There's no uncertainty represented here. And that's the problem with this model, is right. it when you present this to governing boards,
it's deterministic. It's
deterministic. It doesn't allow for consideration of alternatives. And even the alternatives are very limited. So
from the time I started driving a car 26 years ago until maybe like 7 years ago, the cost of gas was somewhere between about 98 cents a gallon and $1.60 or something like that. In the intervening 8 years, it's moved to somewhere between $3.50 and $4 a gallon, you know. And I mean,
Randy's going to take you to school on that point.
Well, I don't need to be taken to school on that point, I don't think. But my point is that the highway oriented model isn't just undesirable because it increases by, according to them, what, like 9% the vehicle travels mile, but because it's simply totally unrealistic. We're not going to be able to afford to do it as a state. There's no revenues to support that model, and there's no foreseeable way that the residents of our community or of North Carolina can afford to actually travel those kinds of miles 28 years in the future.
Well, Mark, why don't we make that our statement instead of just saying, move on to 2040. Why don't you make a statement like that? I will move it if you create it.
I
don't want to put Lydia in a bad position, though. I'm sorry.
This is not some sort. I mean, from my point of view, this is not some kind of hypothetical issue. This is very real.
But as long as you and I have both been in office, when we were first elected, we were saying, I remember this, why are we planning as though nothing's going to change? And here we are 20-some years later, and they're planning for another 20 years down the road as if nothing's going to change.
Yeah. Right.
And we've been making these comments forever. And as long as we keep signing on and going, it's just hypothetical, those 20 years go fast, right?
Sure do.
Yeah. So let's not say, oh, okay, go ahead, because it's not really okay.
So let's say that. This is not okay.
I move this is not okay.
I'll second
all
that.
Right.
And, you know,
all right.
And
thank you,
Jim. Perhaps more specifically that all of these models seem a little unrealistic in terms of their failure to take into account the pace at which the cost of motor vehicle fuel is spiraling out of control.
They're not unrealistic if you make money building highways or building single occupancy vehicles or drilling for oil, then they're very realistic. They're the goals that you want to be setting.
Right.
So I think after we vote on their motion, another motion might be that the model, as you're saying, does not recognize the rate at which fuel costs are rising and the immediate necessity to prioritize alternative forms of transportation and land use patterns that will support them.
And could we say, could we put in parentheses, immediate means less than 2 years? Because sometimes immediate with DOT can mean 20, 30 years. So maybe we need to define immediate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't care. So if you want to say 2 years, that's immediate, less than 2 years. I'd say immediate this year.
Okay, immediate this year. Immediate before Dan
in,
leaves.
In this plan is what we're talking about.
Right, exactly. Okay, immediate, within this year. Gotcha.
All right. To me, those sound like, that doesn't sound like two different motions. It sounds like one motion. Mm-hmm. So I'll take it as a motion from Jackie and seconded by
Sammy
and thirded by Dan, maybe.
Or however.
Wait, wait a minute. I made a motion irrespective.
Let's do this separately. Okay. Let's do this. Okay. Let's do them both.
Yeah, let's clean it up.
All right, so what is the first
motion? My motion is this is not okay. Really, it does not take into account the desire for change in our transportation habits. Mm-hmm. You second that, Sandy?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, first time we've done that, isn't it? Yeah.
All right. So that's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Dan, restate your motion if you
I have to remember it now. My motion was that the plan as drafted does not take into account the rate of increasing fuel costs and the immediate necessity to prioritize alternative forms of transportation and land use planning that will support them.
Okay.
I'll second that.
That's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed.
And in both motions, we were actually moving that they are incorporated in the resolution attachment A, I believe.
Yes.
Clearly. Okay.
I need a little break before we move on.
Okay. We will we'll take a, if it's okay with the rest of the board, we'll take a 4-minute recess, come back at 9:02.
Really?
No, probably
yes,
not.
Really.
But All right. It is, I'm already a minute late.
There she is. And Randy's not in here. You're back.
No, it's definitely not your fault because I'm not waiting for anybody.
We don't need this.
Brings us to agenda item D2, a discussion of the use of mediation in land use regulations. Mr. Manager?
Can I make a comment before we get started?
Go ahead.
I had been thinking, no, I had been knowing that we already had a policy on mediation. And so I would hope that we don't spend, in fact, our policy is so old that we set the standard that other municipalities followed. And we gave presentations on this at the Institute of Government, and I gave a presentation on it to the National Dispute Settlement Center convention here about 15 years ago. And from there, it went on to be used in other progressive parts of the country. And so I'm really glad that we have information from Berkeley in here, and I hope Berkeley will give a nod to Carrboro for where it came from.
I doubt it.
So that said, I would like us not to do a lot of rewriting of something that has already been written and has been part of our ordinance for many years.
Well, is it part? Was it renewed after 6 months?
Yes, it was.
Did you start using it?
Yes.
Because I thought you said in your email that you thought it wasn't. That the 6 months.
It was.
It appears to be. It's in the town code. I mean,
it is in our town
code. Totally forgot.
Oh, yes.
But
okay.
It is in our town code.
It's in the town code.
Yes.
It was only 18 years ago. I mean,
well, can we?
And it's before you. You've got it in front of you.
Okay, but I haven't had time to review it. I don't know about others.
Okay,
so.
But if we were going to change it, because it's part of the town code, it would take more than just this meeting to change it. And what I was hoping to be able, you know, we may have other ways of using it and changing it, but we have before us a situation right now that is one of the reasons, one of the main reasons it was written was for large projects such as Lake Hogan Farms and for the facilitated small area plan and for Vision 2020. Those are some of the main reasons and how we used it. But it was also for these very, very intense localized conflicts that are oftentimes, that sometimes involve whether or not the code's being followed, complaints of neighbors against neighbors, and sometimes the best way to deal with that is not through us and through the press, but is by using a trained facilitated method, and we have the method outlined in our packet tonight of how the Dispute Settlement Center does that. And so the main reason that I brought this up was not to totally rewrite what we do, but to say this is a time when I don't want a situation where somebody gets up for 3 minutes, makes the strongest statement that they can make because they only have 3 minutes, and the next person gets up and makes an opposite statement. And they'll be damned if they're going to come to any kind of resolution between them because they only have 3 minutes. And then we all have to decide, you know, black or white. And that's not the best way to pull communities together and to make decisions that make us whole again. I'm looking for a way for us to have, to be trite about it, a win-win instead of a winner-take-all. And so it would be great at some later point to maybe go back and revisit this ordinance and see if we want to have public hearings to change it, which is what we would have to do. But right now, simply trying to solve an immediate, what feels to be intractable problem that's being fought out in the press and where we're being asked to play good guys, bad guys when there really aren't any, and to ask this board to please look at the process that's laid out in your packet from the Dispute Settlement Center, and let's bring in the Dispute Settlement Center to help solve this, because part of it has to do with our code enforcement or the perception of our code enforcement. So
you are you making a motion that we refer the Johnny's matter for mediation as laid out in
yes.
the town code?
Yeah.
I second that.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Miller, let me just point out that this the existing ordinance provides that the manager is supposed to get together with the Dispute Settlement Center and bring back a proposal for who's going to pay for it. So when you say refer...
I'd like to start that motion then.
Okay. But when you say refer it, does that mean that the town is paying for the mediation and we're going to... it's one thing to refer them to mediation, meaning we hope you to go to mediation. It's another thing to say the town is taking lead, is going to establish with the Dispute Settlement Center a payment scheme and
well, I would like us, I think because it involves the town code and in this case, that we should at least have David go talk to the Dispute Settlement Center, find out before we make any decision, how would you do this, and what would it cost us?
The policy says that DSC will provide mediation services without charge to the parties or the town. That's part of...
We'll make sure they're aware of that.
Right. No. It authorizes the town manager to work with DSC and to strive toward that. I mean, maybe that was part of your negotiation. Maybe back at the time they were a part of this.
Well, there were some times when another party would pay for it. I mean, DSC.
Where does it say that?
DSC never did this for free.
The second.
Well, the parties of the town.
Right.
That's when the town manager refers the dispute. When the board refers the dispute, the indication is that the manager is supposed to negotiate an agreement with DSC covering its services and the cost of DSC services and mechanisms for assuring that such costs do not exceed any appropriation made pursuant to this policy.
Let's just have David talk to them and see what it would cost and what the process it would be. I personally am not interested in 100% consensus process any longer because I think that's manipulated very, very easily. So more of a conflict resolution than the other one.
Than necessarily true consensus.
Yes.
I'll just say we've had preliminary discussions, with the parties to see if they'd be interested in mediation, and certainly we, as staff, and I think as a town, we think it'd be a great idea. And I don't know exactly where that stands now. And Trish, do you have, maybe you've been...
Well, our understanding is that the business managers and property owner, if we're talking about Johnny's in particular, I think we are. They're interested really in making sure that they operate within the parameters that are laid out for them under the existing zoning, and until they go through the process to change the permitted uses on their property. There, two of them are here tonight, and I just want to get their heads nodding, or they can speak to this. But that's my understanding that they did express an openness to the idea of mediation, but their preference really is to move forward with their request for it's currently a request for rezoning the property, and that their intention is to really.
But to their advantage, and the way that it has been done sometimes, is that those kind of conversations happen, we're not at those meetings because
sure.
We skew those meetings. Those conversations happen so that by the time they get to the public hearing and to the official part, the kind of turmoil is worked out and you come with something that both sides feel like may not be perfect but they can live with. So
sure.
I think that would be to the advantage of Johnny's as well as to the neighbors.
And thank you for kind of bringing light on that particular part of it. We have raised the point about the opportunity that lies in front of us to seek some facilitated discussion or whatever. I don't think there's been no conclusion to that particular point in relation to the rezoning part of it, in relation to their application. So I think that is still a discussion that we will have. With them, and of course, Marty has specifically spoken with some folks from the neighborhood about their interest or willingness to participate in
discussion. It can be distinctly to the advantage of both parties to use this process.
I had a question about since this is in the code. It seems like given that this I'm not clear. It was used for 6 months, and there was a trial period, and then it's still in the code, and it just wasn't used anymore?
It was used for a while, and then for reasons that we don't need to get into, it kind of fell out of favor.
Okay, so it seems like someone needs to go back to Dispute Settlement Center to see what their current funding issues are and staffing issues are to see if they have the capacity to do mediation. I mean, they're continuing to do mediations, but which ones are paid for and by who and which ones aren't? Because we can't make that assumption if we haven't been using this process for a long
right.
time. So I'm hoping those discussions will happen as well with their staff.
My right. grandfather didn't.
And I'm hoping
they have been downsized since 1999.
Well,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, could I just speak to that point? I think sorry you just got this evening. I know everybody hasn't had a chance to read through it. So, and we searched and tried to get the relevant materials for you in the packet, but we didn't get everything. So, but the structure of this town code provision is that it sets up these two options, and one is the referral by the Board of Aldermen, the second one is the referral by the town manager, and it specifically states that the disputes that would be referred to by the town manager are really situations where the town doesn't necessarily have an official role, and there are two circumstances that are specified there. You know, either one, there's no ordinance that's covering the matter at issue, and the manager would not recommend adopting or amending an ordinance to deal with it, or two, an ordinance covers the matter, but the manager does not believe that the town should use its resources to enforce the ordinance, and rather, you know, would seek the mediated kind of solution. And that the language is that this is a situation in which the DSC will provide mediation. I mean, this doesn't say, I mean, this is subject to the policies of the DSC, essentially, in terms of whether or not they would pay, not some provision that's been granted to the town. I think that's what the intention of the language is. And so I don't think there was I think there are some policies about how the DSC would intervene and or would assist with problems, and we need to find out.
We just need to talk to them. They're really good at having difficult conversations.
Yes.
So it sounds like David is going to talk about a bunch of things with DSC.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And get back to us, and at that point we may know more about the status of the Johnny's application and where they are in terms of interest in a mediation.
Can I throw out an idea as far as maybe a way to put a little bit finer point on the motion? It seems to me that this is, while this is a good example of the kind of situation where mediation could be helpful, that there are many aspects of the situation that are not merely a neighborhood concern, and that many residents throughout our town have an interest in that, mm-hmm. in the outcome of these discussions. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it would be helpful to go ahead and be a little bit more specific about, to the extent that there is a cost to doing it, about what the town might be willing to do. And so specifically what I want to suggest is that that we go ahead and say that, you know, up to a certain percentage of the cost within the bounds of reason, that the town maybe the taxpayers ought to pay up to, let's say, like 50% of the cost of the mediation effort, so that our town staff has kind of some guidelines or some basis on which to operate in terms of trying to negotiate that aspect of it. Does that seem helpful? I don't know.
My only concern with that, and I'm not saying I'm against it, but my concern with that is precedent, or how will we just address each of these type of situations on a case-by-case basis? Will we have another? We're all well aware of this matter because we've heard a lot from the public about it, and it's been in the news. But what if we have another circumstance that comes before us that the neighbors are, there's a situation where we have two groups that are polarized, and we decide not to pay. I mean, I just maybe we ought to set some kind of policy in place, or if we do it case by case.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that's a legitimate concern. I guess I see it this way, that I've been hearing from by email and phone calls and so forth from a lot of people who live in the vicinity of Johnny's, but I've also been hearing from a lot of people who don't necessarily live that nearby, who feel that they're stakeholders in mm-hmm. this outcome too. So that this is not, you know, this is not merely an issue of my next door neighbor and I can't get along about where I park my car or something like that. This really has more some implications for a broader cross section of our town, and that's how I'm seeing it.
I guess it seems to me that there are specific concerns that certain neighbors have about the plans of Johnny's, and that what the mediation does is allow those neighbors to be in a facilitated conversation with the people of Johnny's, and specifically for the point of them talking through that. That doesn't, I mean, it doesn't leave everyone else out of the rest of the process if there's a rezoning or whatever. But in terms of the mediation itself is focused on the issues between of what the neighbors have, those neighbors have with the plans, is how I see it.
And then when it gets to public hearing, the broader community
it can have its input. Well, I agree, but I'm trying to get to, well.
Well, Mark, I had two questions that I don't know, and I didn't have a chance to really digest what was in this material that was given us tonight, aligned with what Mike generated just a little while back. But there are two questions that come to mind now that, given that we're talking about a very specific situation, and one is if the town sponsors the mediation, would it necessitate it being an open session, and then who decides who the participants are? I think those are two things. If we're discussing this particular situation, I don't know that the former ordinance clarifies that, but help me think that through.
The dispute settlement centers.
I'm not saying that it's not there. I'm just saying I didn't have the time to see how those two questions would be answered.
Well, in that packet, there was information about how they go through the process of putting it together.
Right. So that's right.
The next
dispute
to the
settlement
west
center.
Not in front of you there, but in the packet tonight.
So would that necessitate it being an open session if we're sponsoring it?
No.
Don't look at me. Your attorney's over there.
No.
I think it's your choice. I mean, if you pay for it, I suppose you can specify that if we're to pay for it, this session must be open, or it must
be open, or that it shall not be open, or that the dispute center can work out with the participants. Because that presumes that someone knows who the participants are in such a dispute such as this, whether they're self-selected or selected in some other way.
Yeah. Can I make one other?
Well, no, actually, I need to recognize
Michelle
first.
Yeah, that's me. I just feel like we're having a conversation. I feel like we need to talk to Dispute Settlement Center about what they want to do, because it depends on what facility. They have volunteer facilitators for neighbors who have disputes. But the dispute we're talking about right now, or what we think is a dispute, they're going to have somebody on staff that mediation. And so we're going to, it's going to cost a certain amount of money. And I don't think we can assume what that is and how they're going to handle it without speaking to them. So I'm not sure how much further we can go in deciding how much people should pay when we don't even know what it would cost at this point in time for them to facilitate a dispute like what we're talking about now.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
The other important point that we need to bear in mind is that the ordinance says that we cannot make a referral for mediation without the consent of the applicant. So we can talk to DSC about what, all the questions you guys are raising, But we can't actually make the referral.
That's
the
right.
referral would be a subsequent
right.
step.
Right, we can't force anybody into mediation. We can make it so it's in their best interest, but we can't force them.
Okay. Would you care to make a motion, Dave?
Yeah, the motion is that David's going to talk to DSC about all the particulars of implementing this policy, both in general and in regard to the specific dispute at Johnny's, and report back to us.
All right. Is there a second for that motion?
Second.
I said surely there's a second
yes.
for that motion. All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed. Matter passes unanimously.
I'd like to be excused just because I'm feeling under the weather.
All right.
We need a motion to excuse him.
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Excuse
Sammy. Moved by Dan and seconded by Michelle that we excuse Sammy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Take care.
All those opposed. Yeah. Passed unanimously. All those in favor of Sammy feeling better. That brings us to agenda item 3D3, design update for DB Road sidewalk bond project.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, members of the board, George Saz has some options for you to consider with respect to the sidewalks. It's well on its way.
Before you go ahead, let me just recognize Michelle.
I just wanted to thank the staff did a lot of research on the mediation, even though we already had this in our. And I wanted to thank them for doing it, like 40 pages of research on what we might do. So I just wanted to appreciate the staff for that.
And I just wanted to recognize George and the Public Works staff. At the last minute, they made sure that flags were put up in honor of Pride this weekend. Through no fault of theirs, they got a last-minute request, and they were wonderful in getting those up, and it was greatly appreciated.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, George.
And Michelle and I were just commenting between us on what a snappy dresser you are. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Very nice. Well, good evening, everybody. I will try to be brief here and provide an update on the engineering design for the DB Road sidewalk bond project. Let me first quickly say, though, that the Elm Street project just right over here was finished in September, and that now puts us over 4 miles of sidewalk that
wow.
we have installed. Bids have been opened for Pine Street, and we'll be making an award for that shortly and getting started with that this fall. The design for Davy Road is well underway. In fact, we've obtained at least a little over half of the easements and right-of-way necessary to build the project on the east side of the road. And the east side was selected as it would minimize impact along this project, mostly due to the challenging topography that's on the west side. There's some steep drainage ditches and houses very close and so forth to the road. The plan is to install, let me move on here. The plan is to install a 5-foot integral curb type sidewalk. And for those of you who remember, integral sidewalk is similar to what's been on James, installed on James, as well as what was installed on Elm Street and Ash Street, and minimizes the impact for how far we have to go off the edge of the roadway. So you can see here, this takes from the cemetery from Fidelity Street down to roughly Colson, which isn't shown there, I'm sorry. And then you see Gloss and Circle, and then down to Jones Ferry Road and goes along the apartments. The big question has always been, what was the treatment going to be along the cemetery? And when you look at these slides here, you see the dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
We have trees that are roughly 4 feet, 3.5 to 4 mm-hmm. feet off the back of the curbs, and then the line for these westerlymost graves is 9 feet from the back of the curb. So initially, we looked at the option of putting back the sidewalk at the back of the curb, and yes, we were looking at the removal of roughly 22 trees. We had the trees assessed. Most of them were Bradford pears. There were some oaks, some maples. Only a couple of the trees were truly nice specimen trees. And we thought that we'd be able to do this, remove, and put some sort of treatment behind it, a fence, something to buffer it. But it certainly wouldn't be as nice as, you know, the existing or different than the trees because it would be lower and so forth. These trees are causing some issues, though. They are lifting some of the gravestones that are that you see there. So there was basically no room to do this. So we decided to come up with another idea, and we looked at the option of basically, here's another photo as you go further and a little bit further to the south. Same issue along here. You see all the trees that have been planted. And so we worked with a consultant to come up with another idea, and that basically was to narrow the roadway, basically kind of take the sidewalk out around the trees, and we would put it, you can see the curb in, where's the pointer here? Here's the existing curb and gutter, and then, of course, the root system is up to the back of this, and then the plan would be to remove this, put in the five foot side sidewalk here. The challenge was whether we could do this without having to rebuild the road, and the grade is such that we can do that. Now, what this does, obviously, though, is narrow the road. This section had been paved to Collector Street standards when the apartments were built across the street. So there's this section from Fidelity roughly down to Colson that's 35 feet wide face to face. The rest of the roadway is 22 feet going down the hill and then even going further to the north, and I have some slides to show that. So this was a way of still providing a wide enough area, and compare this to Weaver Street. So we end up with, if you look at the top dimension there, 30 and a half feet face to face. Weaver Street down here is 30 feet face to face. So, which carries
Weaver Street where?
West Weaver Street. I'm sorry, which is out here from Town Hall down to Greensboro.
Uh huh.
Okay. To give you some idea of the comparison, and there we've ended up striping two 10-foot lanes, 5-foot bike lanes. The road carries somewhere on the order of 7,000 cars a day. So even though this is noted as a collector street, it's 25 miles per hour. It's basically built to local street widths, which I think is 20 feet, but it's a little bit wider than that. So this is kind of what we proposed. I've made the comparison for you. I also put in the report, which I can't find here, a summary of the costs and how this would be installing the sidewalk at the back of the curb, resulting in the removal of 22 trees, gets rid of the buffer and so forth. Total project cost then $349,000. Install the sidewalk at the back of the curb, but provide some sort of decorative fencing. And we were looking at kind of a wrought iron kind of thing with some, every 20, 25 feet, some brick pillars or something. But that it was pretty pricey to do that. There really wasn't any room to put much more of a narrow hedge, just no room for any sort of trees. But it would provide a buffer. And then again, the option of integral sidewalk in place of the curb, narrowing of the road, but it's something we think we can live with. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's the option of not doing anything. There is sidewalk on the other side, but then it truncates at Colson, right. Doesn't go any further to the north. And we considered that when we were, doing this. Ideally, it would have been nice to connect either ends, but when you look at the topography, keeping the sidewalk on the west side was not a good option. Mm-hmm. And is the plan we've come up with.
Can you go back a couple slides? Because there's right there, actually, that's perfect. It really shows what the problem is on the right side. You see how it drops away into this swale and away that way. Amount of land you would have to build up.
Yeah, I've got a better picture here. Okay. Hold on a second. There.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can see
that. So there's about three properties, mm-hmm. and the houses are very close. The houses are close on the other side, but you look at the topography, With the houses being higher, we can build that without creating another drainage issues
exactly.
And a
the
few
drainage
other things.
Would be
so easier to cut in a little bit than to fill in a bunch.
Yeah, to do this, you know, this would require a pipe. The hedge would be gone. We'd be buying the, there's a fence there, I believe.
It would be a mess.
And there's several properties. And as you go further to the south, there's a couple of properties also that are very close. More trees. The other side we've been able to do, and we've been negotiating with all those people, and again we've obtained most of what we need.
And that so, west side slope, you know, slopes beyond where those houses are too.
The west side,
the properties all slope west.
Yeah, it's all draining off to the west there.
Yeah. And here, looking further to the north, you can kind of see from this that extending it on the east side is on the right side near the cemetery side. Has a much clearer path, and probably, you know, if that's ever done, is a better way to go.
Right.
That guy's going to find a new place to park, but
yes. So anyway, we basically because of what we're proposing here, wanted you to have a good understanding of that before we go ahead and proceed. And I think it's a good solution. We were able to work it out with the grades. We were able to save the trees. It's narrow, but it ends up 30 feet. It's wider than the rest of what's existing there, so it has that potential.
Great job.
Looks great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jordan.
Creative solution. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
I move we accept the report.
Second.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. The matter passed unanimously. That brings us to item D4. That was only about 4 minutes, but it was about the longest presentation we've ever had from George. Item D4, a discussion of possible regional collaboration regarding stormwater management service delivery. Okay. Mr. Mayor.
Mayor, you spoke earlier about the importance of stormwater management. And, of course, as you know, the town of Carrboro has enacted quite a few of the regulations. We have several things in place in terms of street sweeping and the like, et cetera. I've had some preliminary conversations with the town of Chapel Hill. They approached me with what would be the town of Carrboro's interest in regional collaboration for stormwater management. So, you know, the various aspects of it we've talked about, but I think I'm at a point now to where I need to come to you and find out, are you interested in us continuing to manage stormwater as we currently do on our own, or are you interested in me looking for opportunities with the town of Chapel Hill where perhaps we could share resources, maybe have a consolidated stormwater management? There's various aspects to it. We have a PowerPoint presentation that we could run through some of the different kinds of issues that we'd be talking about. If you want to go through it in that level of detail,
I have just one question that would help me decide whether I need to see a PowerPoint at this point, and that's whether or not working collaboratively with Chapel Hill and and regionally, will it help us in achieving our goals with the Jordan Lake rules?
Well,
is that clear?
If it won't, then we're not going to do it.
I think we can achieve our goals for the Jordan Lake rules on our own. I mean, there's to me, you have a lot of good things in place, and we've got a good handle on stormwater management. We are looking at, as a town, probably, I think, $3 million worth of infrastructure improvements over the next 10 years that we'll need to pay for out of our general fund. But there may be opportunities, again, where we could share resources. Mm-hmm. What I'm asking here is, do you want me to talk with them about it? We're not committing to – I'm not asking you to commit to anything other than that we want to have the conversation and see where there might be opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dan and then Lydia.
Yeah, so you wouldn't anticipate necessarily that it would save money either, I don't think, because we're still – the improvements we have to do in Carrboro, you know, there's no, like, economies of scale by people doing stormwater improvements in bulk or something like that. It's like we got to pay the piper.
Go ahead.
Is that right?
Well, there could be. I mean, I think that's part of the discussion is to determine whether or not there could be economies of scale. The conversation could include whether or not we wanted to establish a stormwater fee. Currently, we're using the general fund to pay for it. That'll be the property and sales taxes. So,
and Chapel Hill has a stormwater fee. Is that
they
correct?
Do.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think you should talk to them, but with focused on really on what the benefits to the town would be. Really, is it going to save us money? As you know, is there some way it's going to improve our capability?
Jackie, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think I have. Oh, I'm sorry, Lydia.
No, go ahead.
I was wondering who would make the decisions and who would set the fee if we go into collaboration with them. And I remember when this came up several years ago that it could create another OWASA type of structure, and we would end up with another utility. And that's been great. There have also been some bumps administratively and with governance. I'd say more with governance than administration, actually, because I think OWASA is very well run. But there have been, so if it's not going to save us money, and how much self-determination would we be giving up, especially if we go into the percentages, which is only fair, that mm-hmm. they're bigger, they're putting more into it, they get more say, like OWASA, and that hasn't always turned out to be to our advantage, that structure. Mm-hmm. So I kind of have questions about that. Randy just whispered in my ear, though, this might be the way to get your fertilizer fee that you've been wanting. So I'm not sure how
more
that
regional
would...
regional approach.
Not sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, those are my concerns with it.
Lydia and then Michelle and then Randy.
Yeah,
Lydia and then Randy.
I think actually Dan and Jackie highlighted a few of my questions. And I another question I would have, and I guess, you know, but that's part of what you would explore, basically, you know, all of the pros and all of the cons, you know, from a practical point, especially our staff, if, and I know you would be entirely aware of this, but if it ends up creating a lot more work for our staff, I know you would assess that, but that would be important also.
Right. I was just going to say, you know, as I'm listening, I think I'd welcome David's conversation and for you to report back to us. I'd be real interested in what your perspective is after, you know, hearing what is being said from others and what their perspective is on a regional collaboration. What are they thinking?
And comparing standards would be part of that analysis also.
We might be able to teach them something.
I know we could. Whether they would learn it is a different question. But obviously it's far too early in the discussion or far too premature to say whether there might be cost savings or not. And obviously cost savings would be an important consideration. But also pointing out, we're doing a good job. We're doing the best that we can right now to collaborate with the town of Chapel Hill in looking at, I think there's a grand sort of Bowling Creek effort that our staff has been working on to date pretty closely with Chapel Hill Stormwater Management staff. But obviously, the direction that conversation is headed would be toward a higher level of integration of our activities, and that seems like there's the opportunity there. It's I guess what I'm saying is the opportunity is not just about cost, but also about sort of the effectiveness of the program, because the whole point of the program is to be reducing the amount of pollution that our community, that both of our communities, that our whole region is putting into Bowling Creek, Morgan Creek, and therefore Jordan Lake and the Cape Fear River. So seems kind of attractive to me at a surface level to at least explore it. Mm-hmm. And I think to the point that you're making, Jackie, about, you know, we don't necessarily want to create a whole other WASA, that one element of one aspect of the conversation ought to be whether there might be some opportunity for a WASA to play a role in performing this function. There certainly, like you said, we have an outstanding the folks who work for WASA right now are outstanding in what they do, and they know how to get stuff done, and a lot from just at a physical level, a lot of the work that we're talking about is very sort of physically similar to a lot of what WASA already does. So I would hope that would be a part of the conversation. I'm not assuming what the outcome might be, but seems to me there's an opportunity there. I share your concern, Jackie, about, if we were to start having stormwater fees or something like that, the way that Chapel Hill does, what our role is at the Board of Aldermen level in determining what those fees are and looking out for the interests of property owners in our community. And I also think that the other sort of self-determination issue is, when I think it was before Randy joined our town staff, but I remember, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago when we saw some presentations that talked about potential sites for stormwater management facilities to be built in our community that, for example, and I'm not ruling this out, but just pointing out how controversial some of this could wind up being when you get down to the nitty-gritty of it all, that one of the proposals that was put on the table at that time was the possibility of building some kind of stormwater detention or retention facility in the middle of Wilson Park in a location that would require taking out our current what's currently a playground in Wilson Park. Well, I'm not saying yes or no to that particular idea. And another one was very near the playground at Carver Elementary, for example. Those types of possible projects are bound to raise a lot of concerns from us as sort of the property owners at Wilson Park, but also from the many, many people who use and rely on that playground that's there right now. So I guess all of which is to say, one of the issues that I want to be looking at or making sure of is that no matter how we address these issues in the future, that the Board of Aldermen has a role to play in making some of those decisions about where stormwater facilities get built, what exactly they look like, and what the impact is on our community as a whole. But I'm, for one, am real interested in hearing more about it.
I just want to make an observation that term stormwater management covers a large waterfront. In particular, there are many things that the town of Carver is now doing and has done well, and I'm thinking especially of the integral role that stormwater management issues plays in the whole land use control process. In other words, that is a huge part or an element of the approval of any kind of development proposal. So there are things that the town is doing and has been doing for years in terms of that would fall under that term stormwater management, and other things that we're not doing, which is building these big major facilities. And at least from my perspective, I think you want to think carefully about any process that would remove that development control aspect of stormwater management and the things that we're already doing. And because you mentioned WASA, one of the things that I don't know whether there's a proposal to have WASA be this entity, but one of the things that they statutorily can do is regulate stormwater or deal with stormwater issues, basically do what we're doing right now in terms of approval of development aspects of stormwater. I mean, they're authorized to do that statutorily. I don't think that's where you want to be headed, but just be aware of different kinds of things that are embraced by that terminology, some of which may offer some possibilities that are attractive and others which I think you well steer away from.
Well, I definitely agree with that, Mr. Attorney. But I think, you know, ultimately the point I'm trying to get at is this, is that, you know, thinking of just Bowling Creek, for example, you know, it runs through both our towns. These sort of publicly built stormwater management facilities are what is going to ultimately be needed in order to improve the quality of water in Bowling Creek and improve the health of the creek and the organisms that rely on it. And you know, you can sort of do that in with 1,000 small facilities spread all throughout its watershed, or you can do it through one gigantic facility way at the bottom of the watershed, or anything in between. And I have no idea what the best approach would be, but I guess the point being that having it wind up that we go with more towards the one model of lots and lots of different facilities, or versus a smaller number of facilities that would need to be built. Having that issue decided by the historical artifact of where we drew our town line seems like not a very logical way to do it, mm-hmm. in terms of mm-hmm. protecting either the creek or the interests of the taxpayers. So. Okay. While I appreciate that both town staffs have been trying hard to work together up to this point, and I think they've been doing a good job as far as they can up to this point, that seems to me that, you know, it's conceivable to me, let me put it this way, it's conceivable to me that a higher level of integration of what they're doing together might lead us to the best decisions as a region for protecting the environment.
Okay.
Anyway.
David, do you need a motion, or is the discussion enough?
I think what you hear there are a whole variety of factors to think about, and that maybe it's best to, we don't even need a motion, maybe just mm-hmm. to say, go ahead and have some of those conversations and consider all those issues as you're having those conversations. Does that sound right, Board?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
All
right.
Thank you.
Thanks, David.
All right. It has come to my attention that next week, is that right? Next week.
Correct, the 9th.
What we currently have scheduled is only two items on our agenda, and that both of them might reasonably wait another week. And the two items are, can you remind me?
NCDOT cameras, which we've kind of talked about.
The DOT camera issue, and then...
And a revolving loan fund for...
PPA Anchor Store. And they can both be moved. And so, we do have the joint meeting next week.
We already have a joint meeting next
Thursday.
Week. What
Thursday.
Day is that? Is that Thursday?
The 11th.
Thursday the 11th with the, is that right? Is it
County Commissioners?
Yeah, it's the 11th.
Oh, Thursday.
It's
Thursday
the 11th.
Mm-hmm. I think it's the 11th. Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Is it Southern Human Services?
It's the 4th.
No. It's in two.
I have it down on my calendar as the 17th.
I can't do it next week.
I probably don't know what I'm talking about either.
All right, let's check.
It's October 11th.
There was some discussion. It's in 2013, it's the 17th.
What?
2013 is October 17th.
What's it about?
2012 is October 11th.
I won't be there.
We'll miss you.
At 7.
Yeah, isn't it at Southern Human Services?
Yeah, we want to cancel.
So you're canceling next week's meeting.
Well, I'm asking y'all if you're amenable to that.
Yes,
sure.
Yes.
All right, so move.
So, whoa, what was moved?
So we're not meeting next Tuesday.
And because we have the other meeting. Perfect.
Right, and we'll move those agenda items to the following week. It's moved by Michelle and seconded by Dan. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right. Does anybody else from the board have any other items?
Do we need a quorum? Because I have to teach a workshop that night, and Dan just said he's not going to be there. Do we need a quorum for the meeting with the county?
We do need a quorum. Well, I mean, yeah, we should have a quorum. I don't know that we need a quorum, but we should have a quorum. But
particularly take any kind of official, sometimes at these meetings, right, the boards separately vote on things, but if you don't, not take any action.
Don't worry, nothing will get
done. And sometimes nothing happens at all for a long period of time.
Usually.
Okay, that'd be fine. I think we're, I think there's reason to believe we'll have at least four members and perhaps five on the 11th. So all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passed unanimously. Oh, we did.
That's the second time we voted twice.
But now that we know that there's only going to be four to five of us, we've re-ratified it. Is there anything else from members of the board? Town staff?
Do we need to schedule when we're going to take care of Kathy's
evaluation?
Do we need to schedule that?